Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to Ancient History in 15 Minutes, give or take a minute. Kenaz Filin here, and I know I promised you that I was going to do more about Sodom this week in lieu of doing something more about Carthage, but as these things go, another subject came up. My good friend MG had a birthday, and he had requested an Ancient History episode on a medieval topic. This isn't quite a medieval topic. It is a late antiquity topic, but it certainly stretches into the medieval period. So, without further ado, this week we are going to be doing the Arthurian legend. And I have a particular soft spot for the Arthurian legend because it was what introduced me to the basic idea of how myths form. You know, I looked at the Arthurian legend, saw some of the historical basis, looked at the time period, and saw how it bred into the myths which became the Arthurian legend. And then I noticed that a very similar pattern appeared in the development of a few raids on an Aegean, like from by Aegeans on Alluvian village, became Homer's Iliad and the myth and legend of the Trojan War. So we're going to start tonight by trying to find the first piece of historical evidence we can find about King Arthur. And that story actually begins about 10 years after the crucifixion, when the Emperor Claudius declares Britannia a Roman province. Now, after that declaration, the Romans spent 4 decades conquering Britannia by brute force. They managed to get about as far as modern-day England, the line where you see modern-day Scotland. They were never able to conquer that. It was really rough going for the Romans for a while, until they decided, okay, you know, we can pacify them by brute force, or we can give them auditoriums, we can give them roads. We have cities here that are prosperous trade centers. You got a whole economy builds up, and there are a lot of benefits to Britannia from getting plugged into the Roman Empire. You start seeing a temple of Minerva Sulis at a hot springs at Bath. Sulis was a Celtic deity. Minerva, of course, is the deity the Greeks called Athena. You could go around, you'd find shrines to Mithras, you'd find shrines to Isis, and they also imported another foreign religion that was frowned on at the time in much of the empire, was frowned on for a good deal of time in much of the empire, Christianity. But as we all know, the Roman Empire collapses in 476, and before that, the empire had been declining for a good century. By 410, they were no longer able to keep legions stationed in Britannia. The legions had to be moved to other fronts to try to hold the empire together. The western part of the empire is completely crumbling. That same year, Rome is sacked by the Visigoths for the first time. A century later, we have a record of this from a saint named Saint Gildas. He was a Breton. He describes a scene of complete chaos as they began getting sacked by the Scoti, who are the Irish, sorry, that's confusing, and the Caledonians, who are the Scots today, from the north. The Irish start sailing in, the Scots start coming down, and they just start completely tearing the place up. You know, as St. Gildas said, the people left their cities, abandoned the protection of the wall, dispersed themselves in flight more desperately than before. The enemy, on the other hand, pursued them with more unrelenting cruelty than before and butchered our countrymen like sheep, so that their habitations were like those of savage beasts. The same year at 443, you know, the year that Gildas is describing, Anglo-Saxon chronicles say this year the sent the Britons oversea to Rome. They begged assistance against the Picts. The Romans said they had none, for the Romans were at war with Attila, king of the Huns. And so the Britons send a message to the Angles, and they request you know, can you send us some assistance against the Picts? And in 449, Vortigern, King of the Britons, invited two people in who are famous in British lore, Hengist and Horsa. Hengist and Horsa come in, you know, they start getting the Pict problem under control, and they also send notes back to their countrymen saying, you know, describing the worthlessness of the Britons and the richness of the land. And so you start getting a bunch of men coming in to emigrate from three different powers of Germany. They are the Old Saxons, the Angles, and the Jutes. A lot of the Britons emigrate across the channel to northeastern France, to a region that even today is still called Brittany. They still speak a close relative of the Cornish language called Brechenog or Breton. So, and others just tried to keep things going as best as they can, hope they would survive through the chaos. And according to Gildas, a leader appeared, organized them, and there was a lengthy campaign until the Britons finally triumphed after a decisive battle at Badon Hill. Now, we don't know where Badon Hill is. A lot of people believe it's Salisbury Hill, which is not far from Bath. The Badbury Rings in Dorsetshire have been pointed to as a possible location of Badon Hill. Some people have said Lyttington Castle in Wiltshire, near the hamlet of Badbury, is Badon Hill. In each site, archaeologists have discovered evidence of Roman and post-Roman activity on each site, but we haven't found the smoking Excalibur. We're not sure when this battle took place. Gildas says, you know, it took place 44 years and 1 month after the landing of the Saxons, also the time of my own nativity. That with landing of the Saxons, we think that Gildas meant around 493. We don't see any listings in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which we have from 455 through the late 9th century, have nothing to say about any British triumph. The Annals Cambriae place the battle at 516. Now, Gildas says that the man who led this battle was the son of Roman nobles who'd been slain by Saxon invaders. He called him Ambrosius. Say that the man was Arthur, who carried the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ for 3 days and nights on his shoulders or on his shield, and the Britons were the victors. And we can see how the name has changed here from Ambrosius to Arthur. Let's see what other changes we could find in our next historical document. That would be Nennius with the 830 Historia Britannium. And his piece obviously works from Gildas' account. Nennius is Welsh. He has access to old Welsh sources and legends. He added those into the story. It's a much more vivid picture than Gildas's. It's not necessarily more realistic. Arthur this time leads in 12 battles, triumphs in each. Eighth battle, he's got an image of the Virgin Mary on his shoulders, and through the power of our Lord Jesus Christ and the Holy Mary, put the Saxons to flight and pursued them the whole day with great slaughter. Then there was the 12th Badon, and at that battle, 940 fell by Arthur's hand alone, no one but the Lord affording him assistance. And you do remember, in our earlier chronicles, we mentioned Vortigern. He's the king who imported the first Saxons into Britain. Nennius adds a whole bunch of tropes to the story of Vortigern that could have come right out of Game of Thrones. There's incest, treachery, seduction. We've even got a banquet where the Saxon hosts slaughter their unarmed Briton guests. There's also a really fascinating story where a young boy leads Vortigern to a hidden pool. There's a tent in the pool. There are two snakes, one red and one white. They're struggling against each other. Finally, the red one chases the white snake out of the tent and into the water. The boy explains that the white serpent is the dragon of the occupiers of Britain, and the red serpent is the dragon of the indigenous Britons. And, you know, it promises here, You know, he tells Vortigern, you can't build a fortress here, but he does promise, you know, at some point they're going to run these invaders out of Britain. And now the Red Serpent does hold the mountains in the area we today call Wales. The White Serpent did stubbornly remain ensconced in the rest of England. The Germanic dialects all become Old English. Dane law becomes part of it. The marauding Vikings settled down, and alongside their Saxon cousins, within a generation or two, these heathens adopted Christianity. And I got to add, you know, they did not adopt Christianity at the point of the sword. These were the people who had the swords. You know, they had settled down around these other Christian farmers, and they became Christian. That's just something interesting. But while we've talked about England, let's take this over to France, where the Franks are currently ruling over a Holy Roman Empire. It's not really very holy, not really very Roman. It's not much of an empire. It does comprise most of modern-day Western Europe, but the emperor has no standing army he can use to defend his territory or control it. He relies on his vassals. These are nobles who've sworn fealty in exchange for land grants or fiefdoms. Those nobles hold their territory by raising troops, and they raise troops by taking their land and outsourcing and providing smaller fiefdoms. And these fiefholders provide manorial holdings to landed knights. And now you get throw in the serfs. They farm the fields in exchange for food. And what you got here is what we today call feudalism. And the horse knights, unfortunately, caused as much trouble as they prevented. If you're a knight without a liege lord, you got to support yourself somehow, and robbery and pillaging was a pretty common way of doing it. And at the same time, as the Northmen in England are becoming Englishmen, another tribe of Northmen land on the shores of northern France. France was facing a lot of raids from Northmen. Finally, they decided they gave a piece of land to a Viking named Rollo in exchange for promising to protect France from his fellow Northmen. And this area, land Normandy, or as we call it in English, Normandy, had became a real center of a very warlike, very Christian culture. They went from being heathens to being Christians to being very good, very religious, but also unsurprisingly very warlike Christians. And they get a little restless and they go across the channel, and in 1066, of course, the Normans take over England. When Britain comes under the rule of the Normans, English stuff becomes very popular in France, and they'd always enjoyed listening to the wandering Breton minstrels they called cantors. They spoke the Gallo-Latin French, but they have this charming Breton accent, and they sang a lot of stories and tales about King Arthur and the noble knights around him. Every cantor had a personal take on the legend. Each insisted his was the true story. All the other cantors were lying. And a lot of these tales got transcribed into Old French by a courtier named Chrétien de Troyes. Now, of course, in 1099, the knights of Europe had managed to establish crusader states in Jerusalem along the eastern Mediterranean coastline. We've also got a craze going through Europe at this time. If you couldn't go to the Holy Land, at least you could rely on a relic from the Holy Land. So you had bones sold as the relics of all kinds of saints. Cloths would be rubbed against the walls of the Holy Sepulchre, that is the purported tomb of Jesus Christ. You'd have water from the Jordan River brought back. There were over a dozen churches displaying the holy prepuce, that is the purported foreskin of Christ that was kept as a souvenir from his circumcision. And These knights had, once they'd been feared as these kind of marauding thugs, and now there was this image of knights as warriors for God. They didn't all live up to that image. The Crusader armies were certainly responsible for a lot of atrocities, but you started getting this image of an idealized crusader, and the contours are singing these tales about knights. They start weaving into these stories a lot of earlier Celtic, Brittonic legends. You get a lot of tales of the old gods. And also in 1191, you get the discovery of England's own relics when at Glastonbury Abbey, the monks discover the bones of the glorious King Arthur and Guinevere, his second wife, in the Isle of Avalon. Now, there was, even at the time, a little bit of skepticism about the Glastonbury find. There'd been a fire in 1184. 1189 had seen the death of Glastonbury Abbey's biggest patron, Henry II. Glastonbury Abbey was really short on funds, and the finding of Arthur was very convenient. But the discovery of these bones was very convenient because it also helped to counter what Gerald of Wales said was a persistent superstition among the Britons, that is, the Welsh and the Cornish, were that Arthur was not dead. He was lying at the Isle of Avalon recovering from his wounds, and that one day Arthur was going to come back from Avalon and return to rule the Britons. And through an old thorn tree, they also tied Glastonbury Abbey and the Arthurian legend to another legend, and this one based in a good bit of historical fact. There was a story that the Glastonbury thorn tree, this is the one that blooms on Christmas and Easter, was planted by Joseph of Arimathea. That's the man who whose tomb Jesus was laying in before the resurrection. He thrust his staff into the ground here in Glastonbury. It became the holy thorn. Now, according to the legend, Joseph of Arimathea was the uncle of Jesus, and Joseph had become rich in the tin trade, and he regularly went back and forth to Cornwall. There were Phoenician traders in Cornwall. In fact, there were Phoenician traders in Cornwall as early as the Bronze Age, so that is actually based in reality. And from here, we see the Arthurian legend take off in all kinds of different ways. In Germany, the tale is transformed into the tale of Parsifal the Pure Fool, which, of course, Richard Wagner will turn into what is arguably his greatest opera. You will see the artworks of the Pre-Raphaelites. You'll see T.S. Eliot looking for the Holy Grail through the wasteland. You see all of this influence on culture. It's just transformed us in so many ways. My personal theory is the Grail legend is the baptism of the Celtic gods into a Christian milieu, and that synthesis of our pre-Christian pagan ideals and Christian Europe was what created what we call today England. In any event, it's about time to wrap things up. Next week, I'll be in either Sodom or Carthage, but wherever we are, I'm sure we'll be having a good time. Thanks a lot for tuning in. This has been Ancient History in 15 minutes, give or take a minute. We gave an extra 5 minutes today. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to like and subscribe.